All right, we've been addressing the topic of shalom in the home, peace in the home. And if you turn with me in your Bibles to Colossians chapter 3, we'll see how some of this peace can be obtained in the home. You know, I'll tell you what, it's bad enough when you don't have peace at work, but not to have peace at home just has a way of sapping all your energy and destroying. There has to be a place where you can have peace and enjoy your family, enjoy your life. And the Apostle Paul here gives us some guidelines to have this peace in the home. Now, we learned last week, and I'm not going to go back over all the details of it, we learned about wives and this concept of loving their husbands and submitting to their husbands' leadership, and then the husbands showing loving leadership in the home and not being bitter because of the responsibilities and because of different things. So we've gone over that. Now we're going to address children. Now I know some people were thinking last week, aha, kids got away with this one. No. Now, when we talk about children, we need to talk about this idea of both mother and father can exhibit the submission they need, can follow the role of leadership, a loving leadership that they need, but if the kids aren't obeying, if the kids aren't listening, there's no shalom in the home. There's no peace in the home. I remember as a teacher, one of the saddest things I ever heard from a parent was, my kid's 10 and I can't stand them. And I was like, oh, I can't wait till they're out of the home. I'm thinking, you've got a long way to go. You know, there's got to be peace in your home now. Right, they do have a human nature. They will become ugly at times. You know, when the kids start to become teenagers, what happened to my mild, sweet little child that hugged me and said they wanted to obey, and all of a sudden, you know, the hormones take over and they're someone else's kid. You know, what happened? That does take place in life, and we as parents have to kind of be there to oversee. Let's take a look at this. The word children here is the word technon, which simply means offspring. It doesn't give an age. It doesn't say between the ages of 0 to 18. When they turn 18, they don't have to listen anymore. It doesn't say that. Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing unto the Lord. For this is well-pleasing. Okay, so the word obey, it's similar to hupotasso, which leads to the word submission that we discussed earlier, but it's a little different. It's hupakau, which means to hupo, which is under, and akuo, which means acoustics, to hear. So to hear something, to subordinate yourself to the person that's saying something. In other words, as my grandfather would say, listen up. You know, listen. Listen to what I have to say. You're not listening. Well, I heard what he had to say, but I guess it wasn't sinking in. Listen. So he's telling us here that we need to listen and follow. And this is in the voice tense in Hebrew or Greek, I should say, in which it's trying to tell us that this needs to be a lifestyle of listening. Well, I listened to you last Thursday. Doesn't that count? No, this is how you are. This is who you should be. Children, those that are in the home ought to obey. They ought to have a lifestyle of obedience and listening. There's nothing that can exasperate parents faster than kids that don't listen. So because of this, this is what pleases the Lord. This is pleasing to the Lord. That is well-pleasing. It's simply that's what it means. Well-pleasing. Approved. So God's standard under normal circumstances is for kids to listen to parents and to obey parents. They are to listen to what they have to say. Your parents have been around before. Your parents have been through this before. And most of the time, for most of the parents, they have your best interest in mind. You know, they're not going to try to get you embarrassed and beat up at school or whatever. You're supposed to listen to them. They know what they're talking about. Even if they don't understand all the details of the iPhone. They know what they're talking about in life, all right? They have a good understanding of these things. Now, there are limitations to this. And I know some people are saying, Wait a minute, there are limitations to obedience on the part of kids? Yes, there are exceptions. Now, I know some of the kids are saying, yes, you know, making my bed, top of the list. No, that's not on the list, just so you know. While some might say you must obey in everything, and it does say in all things, there are areas that under normal circumstances you have to obey in all things, but there are certain areas that the obedience level has to stop. Now, why would that be? Well, let me give you an example. We're told in Romans chapter 13 that we ought to obey the government in all things. We ought to listen to the government. You pay your taxes. Give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. Unfortunately, Caesar thinks he owns more of it every year. But, you know, you give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and you go on. And the government carries out its responsibility or should carry out its responsibility. Well, we know this. Acts 4, some of the disciples were ordered by the government to stop preaching. What did they do? In verses 16, 18, they basically said, we'd rather obey God than man. Now, they got in trouble for it, but they still obeyed God. So that was an exception to it. In Acts chapter 7, Stephen was ordered to stop preaching. He did, and he kept preaching, and as a result, Stephen was stoned to death. So he paid for his obedience to God with his life, but at the very same time, God responded by blessing. Acts 12, the persecution by Herod. They were told again to stop preaching, and Peter was thrown into jail. God got him out of the prison, but he was ordered to stop doing something that was against God. Or he was ordered to do something against God. And what did he do? He obeyed God. Another one, Acts 16. Paul and Silas were ordered to stop preaching. And they kept preaching and they were thrown in jail, beaten and thrown in jail. So there are sometimes consequences when we disobey. However, you have to obey God rather than men. And I'm trusting that if your parents are godly, they're going to ask you to do godly things. Or things that are related to order. Cleaning your room is not a godless thing, just so you know. Taking out the trash, doing the dishes, helping dad or mom with whatever, that's not necessarily a godless activity. Now, if dad comes home and clearly tells you to do something that is against the Word of God, that is against the teaching of the Bible, you can't do it. Let me give you an illustration. This is a little far-fetched, but so dad comes home with two brand new shotguns and says, son, we're going to rob the bank today. We want to give some money to the Lord. Obviously, you don't do that. I don't think that's on the top of the list of what would Jesus do. You know, rob the bank. No! So there are things that you simply have to say respectfully, I can't do that. You know, you may get sent to your room. Of course, you know, when I was a kid, you get sent to your room, you know, you had four blank walls and a bed, and that was it. Maybe a dresser. Nowadays, you know, there's more electronics in the room than on the first few spaceships that we sent up. So what we see here is that children under normal circumstances are to obey their parents in all things. They're to give in to their parents' leadership. They're to follow what their parents have to say. It may seem like it's a pain, but ultimately this is God's standard of order, and they are looking out for you. You know, they're not, I brought you into the world, I'm going to take you out of it. That's not the mentality for most parents, at least in this area. That's not the mentality for most parents. So this is order in the home. You have to have a wife that submits to her husband's leadership. She's there supporting him. A husband that loves his wife and doesn't become bitter over all the different things that need to be done. Children that obey parents. Now, fathers. Now we come to dads. Wait a minute. Didn't you already do dads once, you know, husbands? Well, fathers have a unique role in that they have some major responsibility. Now, in my home, let me just get ready for this. My father is old-fashioned, and he tells me that you're not to enter the pulpit without a jacket. But in my home, I love wearing Hawaiian shirts. They don't have many of these on the farm. So often when I deal with my kids and do things with my kids, I get comfortable and I'll wear a Hawaiian shirt. All right, so I'm going to put my Hawaiian shirt on, and just so I can address these topics. Fathers. Fathers, verse 21, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged. No, boy. Provoke not. Provoke not. Now, I often would wear a Hawaiian shirt when I would do things with my kids. Either they, that way I knew they really loved me if they let me hang around. Provoke not. The Greek word here simply means to cause someone to react in a way that suggests acceptance of a challenge or an irritation as such, and bitter, to kindle resentment or anger. Are your actions as a father kindling resentment, bitterness within the children? Are they causing them to become bitter towards the things of God, towards you as a person? There are times that just being the authority in the home, we do that. But there are some of us that are very good at provoking our children, and we just needle them like a possum under a grate. You know, you just kind of poke and poke and poke because you can. That is exasperating. And the Bible's very clear. Fathers, provoke not your children to anger. Stop doing it. Stop doing it. Now, that's a very simple statement. Because if you don't stop it, they will get discouraged. And I don't just mean they'll be, but there's a whole lot of things that happened as a result of the of a father being oppressive. Let me, John MacArthur, in his commentary on Colossians, does a wonderful explanation of ways that we can exasperate. And rather than reinventing the wheel, I just followed his notes on this, but I will explain what is meant here. Number one. Overprotection. Overprotection. That is, never allowing them liberty, having strict rules about everything they do, not trusting them, and causing them to have despair, which leads to rebellion. Parents must communicate that they trust their children. Now, there are times in which we become over-detailed in what we expect of them. Every single little detail we control. Well, they never learn that way. They never have room that way. While trust must be earned, there needs to be opportunities to build trust. In other words, don't hand over the car keys to a 10-year-old, okay? Don't just give a 10-year-old car keys. Wait until they've learned what to do and how to do it, and then they're 50 and you can let them borrow the car. But parents can also make the mistake of not letting their children fall. Sometimes we're so overprotective, we surround them about everything, there's no room for them to learn. There's no room for them to grow. Over the years, I watched parents do homework for their children. And why? You know, well, I want them to get an A. Well, they're not learning how to do the work. I had a parent that did every single assignment for the kid, and I noticed it in seventh or sixth grade, and I thought, oh, okay, maybe they're helping. And by the time the kid got to eighth grade, the parents were still doing all the homework. And I'm thinking, uh-oh, because they would call me at night at home or send me emails saying, what did you want from this? How do you do this? And I said, well, here's what I, wait, are you doing their homework again? You know, it's okay if they get something wrong. It's okay if it's not perfect. This is how they learn. I have had projects turned in at school that professional artists couldn't have done a better job. And then I have somebody come in with this kind of mess. And, you know, I know the child did this one on his own. I always helped my kids, always worked with my kids, but I never did it all for them. I gave them kind of like the first step up and then let them take over. And guess what? With time, they no longer needed me to do their work or help them with their work. And that was the idea. Sometimes I'd have to sit there and make sure they did their work because their study habits weren't the best. But that is something different. And the one parent I was talking to one time, this is multiple parents, not just one, but one parent in particular, I said to them, you know, the day's going to come where you can't do their work. and they won't know how to do the basic math and the basic science because you've always done it. And the parent said, oh, I'm scared when they get into biology. I'm like, oh no. You've got to teach them how to study because they have to be able to move forward. So it's okay to give a leg up, but it's not okay to do it all, to overprotect. Okay, so they got a C. They're average. You know, so was I. One time, just for my Sarah's sake, one time I was really upset with her for getting a B on some math assignment, and I was pressuring her. I was giving her a hard time. Sarah, you're smart. You're you know, sharp. You should be doing better. You need to study. You know, how do you study for math? I couldn't answer that, but I guess you can. And, you know, go through the practice the problems, go through it. And then my mother pulled out a report card that I had when I was in the same grade. This is what happens when you have a parent that saves everything. So she pulled out that report card and gave it to Sarah. Not to me, but to Sarah. So Sarah showed up with the report card and said, Dad, this is your report card. I said, all right, Sarah, you did a great job. Sometimes we get overprotective. And I understand for safety, that's one thing. But controlling, it gets to the point where they don't learn. They need to experience a few bumps and bruises along the way as they grow and say, maybe Dad wasn't so odd for wearing that shirt. Maybe he was okay. All right, next. A second thing, and this happens, and we often do it unwittingly, and this is a way that I have witnessed, and I try my hardest not to do it the wrong way, but we provoke our children to wrath by showing favoritism. You know, I have to admit, some kids have personalities that are much easier to get along with than others. And some kids just, you know, you say up, they say down. It's just who they are. And no matter what you do, you're going to be at odds at times. Well, I got to tell you, we unwittingly show favoritism at times. And when we do that, we create such a nightmare. It is a destructive problem that we fall into. Examples in the Bible. This is one of the major problems I see in the Old Testament among the families that are reviewed. The example, we see Rebekah favored Jacob and Isaac favored Esau. And what happened? Their favoritism led to major problems in the home. And then as time went on, Rebekah devised a plan to get Jacob to receive the blessing from Isaac. And as a result, he had to run for his life, and she never saw her son again. It totally destroyed the home. Well, and it set the pattern for Jacob, because later, when Jacob was married, he favored two of his children over all of the rest. Especially, he favored one of his children, Joseph, before Benjamin was born. And as a result, the others rebelled and did harm to Joseph. Now, God used it for good in the long run, but it destroyed that home. Favoritism is a major problem. Playing favorites leads to destruction within a home. It destroys. And ruination, we have to be so careful. You know, to this day, my wife and I know this sounds petty, but to this day, whatever I spend on one child for gifts, I try to spend on the other two for gifts as well. However, the number is of gifts, we try to match that as close as we can. Even today, now that they're adults, we try to do that. Now, it's very easy with one grandchild. You just spoil the kid. But you know, when there's other grandkids, we're going to try to do the exact same thing. Why? Because we have witnessed favoritism and how it has messed things up. And it is so easy to get into, and you just can't do that. So we can exasperate by overprotecting, by showing favoritism. We can exasperate by not appreciating their worth, by not showing them that they're valuable, by not listening to them. You know, failure to listen. failure to care, failure to take the time that's needed to make a difference. You know, being focused too much on our lives instead of theirs will often turn them away from God. I remember when my son was a little boy, I've told this story before. I think he might remember it. He was about 3 and a half, and Sunday mornings were a big thing for us. There was a flurry of activity, and he didn't want to. I sent him to his room to get ready for church, and he came out wearing his sweatpants and sweatshirt, and I said, "Well, you're not getting ready for church?" And he goes, "I don't want to go to church." And I'm like, "What?" This was very uncharacteristic. And I said, "What do you not want to go to church for? We love God." And he said, "Church takes you away." And I began to realize that this 3 and a half-year-old saw me gone. Hours and hours every day, hours and hours during the week. I was always doing something for somebody else's kids, but not my own. And I realized that I needed to be home more to focus in on them. When I came to Robertsville, we used to, I don't know if you remember this, for those that have been here a while, we used to have every Sunday, Sunday school, Sunday morning, Sunday night. Every Monday we had a meeting, whether one Monday was deacons, another Monday be trustees, another Monday would be like hospitality or Sunday school. Every single Monday we had a meeting, unless there was like a fifth Monday of the month, which didn't happen often. Every Tuesday and every Thursday, we had our Bible Institute going. So I was out for Bible Institute. Every Wednesday, prayer meeting. Every Friday, we had volleyball, family night. And every Saturday, we either had something we had to do, wanted to do, or should do, or somebody I had to visit. And I remember telling my father when we first got here, I'm working all day, and every night we're at church, and you know what? It's going to mess up my home. So we kind of moved all the meetings around and eventually moved the meetings to quarterly meetings or to Sunday meetings because we needed time with our families. My kids needed to know that I cared enough to show up when they were at a game or when they were doing extra work or when they were playing in the yard and I'd try to be there with them. So not listening to them is a major thing. Not having time. Well, I have quality time. Well, what is quality time? The greatest conversations I've ever had with my father and grandfather has been time where we didn't plan on it. We were fishing. We were riding on a tractor or something. And then I would ask questions. And those were the teachable moments that if they weren't with me, we would never have had because I never wrote them down and said, here's five philosophical questions that I must ask you this week. It would just hit my top of my head. Well, why does God allow this? Or why did that happen? And they would teach me. Number four, by setting unrealistic goals. How can we exasperate our children? By setting unrealistic goals. Sometimes the goals we have are goals that we could never have obtained ourselves. We never reward them. We never say, well done. We never encourage them. The Bible in Proverbs 22:6 says, train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. The word train up is a very interesting term. It means to touch the palate. Now, why would the Bible use a term, touch the palate? You know, food. Give them the right taste. Give them the right taste for the right things. Now, I've noticed that each child has certain things that they have innate talents with, and they have areas that they seem to enjoy. Those are the areas you have to push. If a child has, even as a youngster, music is something that they're attracted to, then you can develop that. If they are the kind that can't sit still and they're always using their hands for something, then develop that. Use what they have and develop them. Give them the right taste. Not just taste for any music, but the right music. Not just taste for anything to do with their hands, but constructive things. So we are to develop them. And when we have unrealistic goals, and even like I mentioned already, you know, expecting every child to come up with straight A's on everything when I was a straight C student on my best days. You know, D's were not permittable, but the C's, I went to school back when a C was average. Everybody got a C, you know, pretty much. And if you got a B, that was, wow. If you got an A, it was, ooh, they're a genius, you know. And now if they don't get an A, the teacher gets a call. What happened? What'd they do wrong? Well, so by setting unrealistic goals, sometimes we put the bar too high. And it's something, and don't put it so low on the ground that they don't have to work for it, but make them work for it. But don't make it impossible. That just discourages. All right, another way that we exasperate them is to fail to show affection. You know, my father grew up in an age where men never said, I love you. Men never hugged their children. He grew up in a time period, my grandfather, you know, you don't show weakness. And yet, I'm so glad that my father, when he came to know Christ, he wasn't like that. He wept with us. He spent time with us. He showed us affection. I heard the word, I love you. That ought to be said and exemplified in our home. You know, my father was 40 before he received a card. I still remember this. And it said, love mom, pa. And he bawled like a baby and he said, they love me. He never heard those words his whole life. You know, we ought to be loving people, not just verbally. You can say something and you don't mean it. I was talking to a fellow one time, and he and his wife were out of sorts, and he said to me, you know, preacher, what can I do to have my wife, you know, so she's more agreeable? And I said, well, does she know you love her? And he goes, I said that at the wedding. Why do I need to tell her again? It's like 40 years later. I imagine she's kind of curious. You know, by not showing the affection that they need. Even plants need sunlight. Even plants need nourishment. Even plants need water. And if you skip those things, you got a mess. They won't grow. The same with our relationships. We exasperate children often by not providing legitimate needs. And what I mean by these is food, shelter, clothing. And you don't have to get the best, you know, $130 sneakers. I don't even think I own, you know, with three pairs of shoes, they come close to that. Maybe more. The most expensive shoes I own are work boots, you know, and they last for like 8 years. It's you don't have to get the most expensive sneakers that'll wear out in 6 months, just so you know. When I was a kid, I used to go through sneakers pretty fast. Boys don't care. You wear your sneakers, you got them on. If there's mud, you go through the mud. If there's snow, you go through the snow, you know? So anyhow, we ruin things. But simply providing what they need, food, shelter, clothing, giving them the proper diet, getting them the proper rest, sometimes we don't provide for their legitimate needs, and then we create problems. Being in an affluent area as we are here, that's not as common, but it is in some areas where, if they want something, they want food, they have to go get it. He's 15 years old, you know? So we need to provide for their legitimate needs, and we also need to help them understand if they have wants. So you don't like your sneakers, well, here's how you can get more money to buy better sneakers if you want to buy better sneakers. You know, my parents, if I wanted a car, if I wanted the insurance for the car, if I wanted a motorcycle, I had to work for it. And then I began to realize after weeks and weeks and months of working at my grandfather's farm, wow, I'm not so sure I want to buy that. Because all of a sudden, I saw the value of it. But providing the legitimate needs and then helping them to learn the value of things is essential. We exasperate them when we don't do this. We exasperate children by a lack of standards, the opposite of overprotection. Yeah, do what you want, I don't care, whatever. These children are left to their own. And then they can't handle the freedom and they become insecure. We need to put a hedge about them. There ought to be rights and wrongs that they know they cross, that's the end of it. You know, you lose more freedoms. And this is not overprotection, but here's the boundary lines. You know, don't ever say this to your mother or to me. That's the line, all right? You got it? You can go up to that, but don't you dare cross that. And, you know, my son, this is kind of a funny story. When he was little, for his second birthday, we got a dog, and he and the dog were always together. And every day that they would go outside, because we used to send it, we lived in the middle of a vast area of country, and I put up a fence, a sheep fence around our yard, because I didn't want, you know, wild animals. We had coyotes. I saw a mountain lion one time. Not that they couldn't get over the fence, but it gave me a sense of security having a fence in the yard. And so every day that my son and the dog would go out, they would, I noticed this, they would walk outside, they check the fence, the gate, they'd go all the way around the thing, all the way to the other, and check the other gate, and then they'd go out and play in the middle of the yard. It was almost like, we can play now that we know the gates are shut and the fence is secure. And I think he was doing it so the dog wouldn't get out, because the dog had gotten out before, but there was a sense of security, and he couldn't go play until he double-checked everything. That security is us. We provide the fence. We provide that fence for them, the boundaries, and that helps establish right and wrong for them. Another way that we as parents often, fathers often provoke them is by destructive criticism. A child learns what he lives. A child learns what is right and what's not by what he sees and hears. We can be, as parents, especially dads, hypercritical. Every time they say, look what I did, we stand there and correct it. We stand there, you know, I wrote, and we stand there and grade it and put a red letter grade at the top of it. Every single thing they do. Yes, you want to give positive criticism, but you want to reinforce. You don't want to destroy. Why, if I did it, I would have, you know, well, you're not competing against a seven-year-old. And as parents, it's not always a competition. And sometimes, as men, we make it that. So if your child is hypercritical of everything, of what you do, what your wife does, it's probably there's some place he learned that at home. We have to be very careful not to be so destructive in our criticism. We ought to build up and mold in a positive way instead of cut down. We have to be careful to do that. Constantly, you should be reaffirming and saying, good job. Here's, hey, can you help me? Let me show you how to do it. And, you know, well, if you held the drill straighter, it wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't be falling off the screw all the time. Well, how? Well, let me show you. And instead of saying, you big dummy, you know. So there ought to be positive ways. Two more. One way is by neglect. By neglect. We as parents sometimes get so busy, I have to tell you, we neglect our kids. David ignored Absalom. And it was over a year that he wouldn't see him. And as a result, Absalom took things in his own hands. David got mad at him, wouldn't talk to him anymore. And then eventually it led to another problem and another problem. That neglect, David should have been more involved. He was a great king, but a bad dad. And I think if you ask him today, which he would have been rather succeeded at, he may have chosen to be a better dad. So your kids need your care. And believe me, it's a lot of work. You want to sit down and do your own thing. I mean, there's things that I want to do, and they need help. That's what I'm there for. I have to tell myself that. That's what I'm. This is my job. That is the most important thing, taking care of my family, not just, you know, hey, I worked hard, I got to put my feet up. Now, kids, you could do a whole lot of good. Let them eat first. Feed the grumpy bear, and they get a smile, all right? So don't hit them right away with everything. And then finally, excessive discipline. We exasperate our children by excessive and sometimes cruel discipline. I am a firm believer in discipline. I'm a firm believer in standards. But discipline is never an excuse for abuse. It's never an excuse to be heavy-handed. It's never an excuse to be quick with the belt or whatever you want to use. And yet there are some that is their first reaction to everything. It's swing first and find out later what the truth is. Your children should have respect, but not fear. They should have a godly respect for you, but not a fear of not knowing how you're going to react. So these are just some simple ways that we, parents, dads especially, provoke their children. My advice to fathers, aside from buying a Hawaiian shirt, my advice for fathers is Be the man you want your children to be. Be the kind of man you want your children to be. Model the character, integrity, holiness, love that you want them to have. And there are times that I have failed in to do this. And my kids are here as testimonies. A lot of times I would sit down with them. We'd sit down together and I would apologize if I failed. I would tell them, look, I kind of blew it in this area. I'm sorry. Forgive me and let's work together on how we can correct this. And I would apologize. I disciplined my son when he was a little boy one time, and it wasn't his fault. It was the middle child's fault, who shall remain nameless. She did it. And he got punished for it, and I apologized to him. And that stands out in my mind even now, because being a godly man means that you are capable of saying, I was wrong. I was wrong. Now, what does it mean that they get discouraged if we provoke them? To be discouraged means to become disheartened to the point of losing motivation, a broken spirit. They become weakened, destroyed. And guess what? They're going to look other places for that love and attention. So there's a balance. What a job. There's a balance. And this is what we're called to. We're called to that balance. And I have to admit, there is no relationship other than family that is so rewarding and so exhausting and at times so discouraging. And it can be so discouraging, but what a blessing it is that God has given us these opportunities. So to have peace in the home, we see that there has to be, someone has to take the lead, and there has to be submission to this. There has to be love and not bitterness. There has to be obedience, and there has to be this loving leadership that doesn't and that refuses to provoke others. What a blessing. What a blessing it is to be able to be in that position that you have that much of an influence on someone's life. Hey, at work, nobody listens to you. And yet at home, they're following your example. What a blessing that is. Lord, I pray, as we lean upon you, that you might give us the ability to stand fast, the ability to live for you, the ability to serve you, the ability to be that example. And when we fail, and we all will, help us to be able to forgive ourselves as well as receive the forgiveness that we need. Lord, thank you for the opportunity we have to make a difference in the lives of others. Bless our homes and bring peace in Christ's name.